Welcome back, everyone. I now request TICON co-chair, Mr. Al Kapoor, to introduce the luncheon keynote speaker, Mr. Howard Anderson.
So we're all warmed up, and we are ready to take this question of flatness head on. We saw a video. How flat is this world? So we're going to jump right into it. So the questions that we have, at least I have on my mind right now, going from room to room and listening to speakers, are the resource and capabilities really evening out? We hear about India and China every day. What is the truth? Are there brand names ahead of delivery? Should you defy conventional wisdom? Should you invest, partner, find a supplier, or market your products in these countries? These questions are at the heart of this conference, and Howard Anderson will provide us original insights. Howard needs no introduction. He's frequently quoted in Boston Globe, New York Times, Fortune, Wall Street Journal, and Business Week. He founded the Yankee Group, which was acquired by Reuters. He co-founded Battery Ventures with billions in investments in firms like Nextel, Akamai, and InfoSeek, firms that you know. He's now on the MIT faculty. He will also be teaching in leading schools in India next year, so that's really exciting. Please welcome Howard Anderson.
You'll notice I'm going to talk about India versus China in the year 2016. I'm not that dumb to try and do it today. The world is flat, but the world is spiky, too. I'm going to make that point. It's not flat for everyone. You know, in the old world that we lived in, assets were physical. Timber, oil, coal, low-cost labor. This new world, maybe it's education, R&D investment, or maybe something as ephemeral as knowledge infrastructure. So as we look out 10 years, India is in a pretty good position. It leads in the new world technology, and China is the old world technology. But ask yourself the question, why not Poland? Why not Russia? Why not France? What is it that made this work the way it is? Why not Britain? I mean, we're Anglophiles here. We love Britain. The products don't work, but we love Britain. You look at Mercedes and you look at Jaguar. If Jaguar actually had ever made a car that worked, Mercedes would have been an afterthought. Okay, if we go back 40 years, 1966, and you looked at both India and China, you would say, nothing's happening, nothing's happened since 100 years ago, and probably nothing will happen in the next 50 years. You would have been dead wrong. India is the world's fastest growing software factory. China is the world's leading manufacturer of whole bunches of things, including wooden furniture, consumer electronics, and whatever. No country has ever climbed every step of the economic ladder as quickly. Okay, let's go ahead and look at 2016. What are the... Okay, I want to go back one. The largest economies in the world in the year 2016, China, one. The United States, two. India, three. Japan, four. Germany, five. India will pass Germany this year. China will pass the United States in the year 2012. Now, there is a soft underbelly around the world, and that is the enormous issue of taking care of older people. Japan, the United States, Europe has this problem. Internet, of course, is changing a lot of the basic superstructure. It is a great leveler. And in some cases, it's possible to leapfrog. Yes, we understand that the highways in India suck, but if I'm writing computer code, does it really matter? China so far has moved atoms. India has moved electrons. Today, there are 4.2 billion internet addresses. There were more transistors produced last year than there are grains of sand in the universe. Okay, well, those are great statistics. But now what? Let's go back to 1962. What happened in 1962? Well, we had Vietnam here, but there was the Sino-Indian Border War, which was fought at 14,000 feet. What we're going to see, I think, is another border war in 2006, fought at sea level. If you could make an investment today in a stock, one called India and one called China, what would you do? Now, the next war is going to be a war of science. And most wars are fought between attackers and defenders. Are you an attacker or a defender? So there's this wonderfully interesting world of rivalries. Good versus evil. The Red Sox versus the Yankees, which is the same thing as good versus evil. Hertz versus Avis, Duke versus the University of North Carolina, Microsoft? That's interesting, because when I look at Microsoft, what I see is they go to war every year. They go to war with IBM. Was Microsoft an attacker or a defender in that war? Attacker. Novell, attacker. Netscape, attacker. AOL, attacker. Linux. Defender. Interesting. Google, defender. My friend Bob Buderi has written a very interesting book called Guangxi, G-U-A-N-X-I. And it is the story of Microsoft's new lab in China. Why did Microsoft build this lab in China? Because of low costs? No. Because China is an enormous market? No. Because of first-rate brain power? Yes. And according to Ballmer and Gates and those guys, the Microsoft lab in China is already the second most productive in any lab they own in the world. So we went for brains, not cost. Where else does Microsoft compete? Well, Department of Justice, defender. Sun, attacker. Sony, attacker. Oracle, attacker. The European Commission. One of the ways you know you have succeeded is when you're sued for antitrust. That's one of the ways that society tells you you have been very successful. I've just did an interesting article about Microsoft versus Cisco, and essentially look at unified messaging and whatever, and saying they are essentially coming head-to-head. When I talked to Chambers and Gates a few years ago, and I said, it is inevitable that you guys are going to attack each other on part of the ISO model. No. We are of our own spheres of influence. We have great respect to each other. It was like Don Corleone saying that Barzini is his lifelong friend. Okay, so we have some rivals out here. Let's talk about the one I want to talk to, which is India versus China. I mean, maybe, Howard, it should be India and China versus the United States or versus Europe. Now, this is a war of science. When I look at some of Fiona Murray's work over at MIT in terms of scientific publications, India, I'll just give you the statistics, published 31.7 publications, China about 23, this is per 100 or whatever, U.S. about 4. Now understand that if you are an attacker and you succeed, ultimately you become a defender. Many people attack. The whole venture capital industry is built on the premise that we fund attackers. But realize for attackers, it's kind of like sperm swimming upstream. For all but one of them, it's going to be a very bad day. So not all attackers succeed. Now, are we going to see the Indian Institute of Technology versus Chengdu University? Yes. Isn't the U.S. a defender? Yes. All right, let's look at China and India together. China, 140 cities with over 1 million population. The U.S. has 9. All of Europe has 36. Both are opening to development. Both represent massive risks. India has bad infrastructure, poverty. Remember, sometimes your liabilities may turn into assets, which is exactly what happened in China. They had low-cost labor. They turned that as a catalyst into an engine of development. India, democratic government, good education. India in the process of routing out corruption, okay? Now, is it possible to skip over parts of development, like China is, in example, in wireless? When I look at where the money is being spent in both countries, what I find, for example, is the majority of technical papers written in China are in material science. In fact, the number of material science papers are 2 times what you see from India. Physics, 3 times. Mathematics, 4 times. Where do I see interesting papers in India? Bioscience, agriculture, some material science. That's where companies are spending their money. Now, let's look at China for a moment. China. The Chinese were never really communists. They tried it. It didn't work. These are natural capitalists that were kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing there. They were natural capitalists doing a little communism. They flirted with communism for 40 or 50 years, okay? Very weak legal system. There is possible instability. Lots of investment in atoms, lots of investments in infrastructure. They are building 40 airports in China. We have built 1, Denver, in the last 40 years. And some people are still waiting for their luggage. Built infrastructure, that was their view. We've got this asset, what can we do about it? What can give us, quote, mutual benefit? Where will we attract capital? When I walk through MIT's area today, and what I see in terms of the biology departments at MIT and other major universities, what I find are old, brilliant Jewish biologists teaching brilliant young Chinese women. And the fact, when you think about it, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, why did Japan fail? Japan failed because their costs got out of line. Japan never embraced women. They educated the women, and they never essentially put them as part of the workforce. Now, here's the conventional wisdom that you have all been spouting one way and the other, which is, okay, listen, conventional wisdom says India and China will coexist very much like Microsoft and Cisco. Each will become dominant or stay dominant in the areas they know well. India, a power in software. Now, by necessity, India must go from what it's doing to develop unique software products, which it has not done. China is and will stay the world's factory. They will make products. I submit the conventional wisdom is once again dead wrong. India needs a much broader base than software. It needs those manufacturing jobs. It needs atoms. 3 million people in high tech is an infinitely small number. China says, we got to go to higher value products. Desh and I were in China a while ago, when we saw some factories. A typical factory worker in China makes $125 or $150 a month. That person supports 6 people back in rural China. Her mother, her father, perhaps 1 or 2 grandparents, and a sibling. Really? So what the Chinese have said
is we will use this to get out of poverty. We will stop taxing the rural areas. And this workforce supports whole different parts of our economy. Now, let's think about strategy for a moment. Not just company strategy, but country strategy. The role of strategy is to upset the status quo. Whatever the status quo is, if my strategy is correct, I redefine the status quo on a more favorable basis to myself. Let's go back to 1990. Status quo in computing. U.S. companies, in comes Japan. Japan was a power in personal computing. Japan was a power in mid-range and in mainframe computing. Japan let its costs get too high. We would sit around in 1990 and read books like Japan is number one. Now, 2006, China wants to change the status quo again. They are an internal vast market. They are low cost. They have enough to get scale. When I look around and I see that every major U.S. company has a strong relationship already in India, Microsoft, GE, IBM. IBM says they're investing $6 billion. Why? Low-cost labor, diverse engineering. They're doing telecom in New Delhi. They've got 43,000 employees. They are the largest foreign employer in India. Then I say, you know, very few things are truisms in life, but one of which I'll go to the grave with, IBM is always wrong. Okay? I see some major corporations. Infosys is a billion-dollar company. Tata, Wipro are moving ahead at pretty much flank speeds. All have taken advantage of the university system, the work ethic, and lower cost. Realize that so far, no one is making money in China. China is a cash sink, not a cash source. Does that change? Well, we'll think about that a little bit. But the issue that we have today is when you look beyond the obvious, what you find is some pretty deep thinking inside of China. Example, Howard. Okay. Next year, China will be the largest manufacturing of television sets in the world. Actually, they are this year. Now, what's the next generation of television set going to look like? Well, Howard, all said and done, it's a computer. Oh, really? There's going to be software in that television set. The Chinese want that software revenue, and they're going to go after it aggressively. Question. It's the year 2016. Will India be the low-cost development center that it is today? In just 6 years, I've seen software and program managers have their salary increase from $6,000 to $30,000. Now, when I look at China today, it is littered with wrecks of companies who went to China, I think, just for the bragging rights. We're in China. Yes, I understand all those things. Can I get 10 PhDs for the price of one? Can China do to India what India did to the United States? Okay. Imagine you are the chief information officer at a major corporation. What have you done in the last 10 or 15 years? Well, the call from your management is don't give me any of that horseshit strategic stuff about information. Drive my cost down. Drive my cost down per transaction. Drive my cost down in application development. Drive my speed up in applications and development. So the first thing I did is I explored outsourcing. And I went to maybe IBM or maybe EDS or maybe computer sciences. And that worked for a little while. And then maybe I started to do outsourcing in India. Do I now begin to consider outsourcing in China? Whoa, really? Mm-hmm. How much? Maybe a little bit, a no thank you helping. But if I'm going to push and be pushed by my management to drive my transaction costs down, I've got to start to think about 5 and 10 years ahead. It's just not collaborative R&D and hiring and whatever I'm talking about. I am talking about, do I start to think about doing this development in other places? Now, the infrastructure in the atoms become an interesting issue. Desh is the chairman of TGS Networks, which is a communications company in Bangalore. Battery Ventures is an investor there. And you say, okay, here's a natural advantage of doing communications products in India. A large part of what we will build is software. We still have to put that in some kind of box. Now imagine this issue. You're in the United States, you're in Boston, you're building a product, and you got a soldering problem. Okay? Where do you find expertise? Right out on 495. There's more X digital equipment, whatever, engineers who have solved that soldering problem. That is an infrastructure problem that you have solved. If I have a solid soldering problem in China, I don't have a problem. If I have a soldering problem, I'm only using this as an example, in India, the nearest true expert may be in China. So the infrastructure is not that unimportant here. Essentially, what I'm saying is you need both. Now, what else is interesting? Maybe you saw an article in the paper the other day about quality. And they listed the automobiles that had the highest quality rating. Number one, Porsche. Number two, Lexus. Number three, Hyundai. If that didn't wake you up about who might be an attacker, you haven't read these tea leaves. Malcolm Brooklyn is starting to import high-end cars from India, but not at the lowest level. He is going after the BMW market. Good price, high performance. Let's think about Israel for a moment. Israel has more PhDs as a percentage of population of any country on earth. One of the problems in Israel, there's only 6 million people there. It's not big enough to scale. Israel must export all its products. So when I look at, you know, this world market, I'm saying, is India going to need some help in keeping its costs low? Will they need software automation? Well, won't China need manufacturing automation? No. Automation in China is too expensive because at $125 a month, it's cheaper to have people there than it is to bring in automation. When I look at China today, I see 3 million privately owned companies, of which 10% would qualify for listing on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. Probably 1% of them, 3,000, would be considered first tier. Is capital available? Yes. Trillions. Where does it go? India? Yeah, there's plenty of money available in India. Where's Harvard going to put its money? $34 billion. Harvard will put its money in every other university where it is welcomed and where there is return. India is importing talent. Infosys is adding 25,000 employees from around the world. Tata is bringing 1,000 people from the U.S. to the 30,000 they have. Why? There's a labor shortage in India. Are they considering importing and training from China? Today, there's about 10,000 Americans who work in India for Indian information companies. I got a nephew, graduated from Columbia this year with a degree in physics. He starts work in Mumbai next month for a systems integration company where he'll be writing communication software. Now, I don't know what that does to the internal cost structure, but let's assume that the cost structure goes up. Are they paying him well? Quite well. Does he know anything? No. Of course not. Let's think a little bit about Japan, because that's a very interesting thing. Japan started out low cost, low quality, 1950. Denning came in, taught statistical quality control. What did Japan do? They first went in and built a starter business in wiring subassemblies. All you really need to do that at the time was fast fingers. It could have been done almost anywhere. Japan had a cost advantage. Then they began to put together the chassis. Then they began to private label. And finally, they had whole computers. Kobayashi was the chairman of NEC. And the chairman in a Japanese company has kind of a mythical presence. Doesn't essentially run the company. He thinks the future. And Kobayashi came down from the mountain one day and he said, I've seen the future of Japan. It's C&C, computers and communications. And for about a year, the Japanese executives would talk to each other, what does C&C really mean? To me, that was pretty obvious, but no, they talked about it a little more. And they said, what Kobayashi really meant was C&C, components. We have to go back and be in components if we're going to be a major factor. If you look at Toyota today, 75% of its profits are out of Japan. China is its factory, partially. Japan does the design. Now, that used to be the model here. Design it in the United States, manufacture in China. Except China wants design, too. China wants design. There is a city in China that has one factory with 80,000 employees. They make products for Nike, Adidas, and everyone else. There is the Adidas line. There is the Nike line. There is X, Y, and Z line. Design comes from the United States, and essentially that's what the plan is, except they're running that line a few extra shifts, and they're making their own products there, and they're putting their own label on it. In other words, R&D is going to be outsourced also. How about another example? Yeah, I look at airplanes. Japan was a large market. It had scale. It wanted in. First step, build the fuselage. The fuselage is essentially an aluminum cigar tube. There's not much technology in the fuselage. Then, moved up to the control panel. Finally, the core. Let me talk about a friend of mine years ago, where a lot of this got started. It was a man named Kailash Khanna, who is the CIO of American Express, probably 1985, 1990. He worked for Lou Gerstner, who was running travel-related services at American Express. And Kailash would call me in and say, Howard, tell me about communications tariffs. Where are they going? And I said, well, Kailash, I think they'll probably be going down 13% per year compounded. And Kailash said, well, that's very interesting, because what that means to me is that I can trade off one for the other. I can begin to do software maintenance. I can do it in India during the day, and by the time we're done, it's back in Florida or Phoenix or whatever at night. I can drive my cost down. Obviously, we have a labor base in India. In my mind, this is when outsourcing really took off in India. Okay, those are good models. Now, what's China doing about this? One of the things I see China doing is practicing a polite form of extortion. China goes to major companies, such as Motorola, and says, do you want into our market? Yes. Okay, here's what we want. We want to share in the technology. We want to use some of our intimidation and our clout to demand a higher level of intellectual property. We'll build up the infrastructure to support the domestic market. Korea, by the way, is doing the same thing. We will use education, innovation, to become a world technical power. China has to increase its gross national product 7% a year just to keep up with its population. This isn't 7% from a small base. Now, India, where will unique software come from? It's not just taking in laundry from other companies. Essentially, unique software comes when you have a unique opportunity or a stress. A wonderful case I give is years ago with Johnson & Johnson, an American hospital supply. If you remember at the time, Johnson & Johnson would make products and they would give it to a distributor who would distribute to the local hospitals. There was a pain in the butt purchasing agent from Stanford Medical School who would call up the local distributor for Johnson & Johnson 8-10 times a day. Do you have syringes in this size? How much? Do you have gloves? How much? Do you have this? How many in stock? Ba, 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 ba. And finally, someone said, would a terminal shut him up? And they did. They took their internal database and they gave it out to their customer. But the real genius was someone that said, everybody needs this. And we can essentially own this market. Johnson & Johnson, the manufacturer, was forced to go into this business because American Hospital Supply merged with Baxter, started to come up with their own product. Adversity builds these unique software products. Capital. Where's capital going to come from? Because isn't this really a battle of talent and capital? I see the VCs investing in India not for outsourcing, absolutely not, but for a seat at the table when India eventually builds a proprietary software business. And they will say, okay, here is open source, here is a weapon, let us build unique software, and we think that is going to be the market. When I look at where foreign investment is coming from about 1980 to 2000, the United States was the largest recipient of foreign investment. By 2003, China had passed the United States. And that year, $53 billion in foreign capital was invested in China, $40 billion in the United States. Is that a catalytic role? Yeah. One half of China's trade is controlled by foreign firms. So by opening up even that little bit, they got a multiplier effect. Another question. Why is it that the Soviet Union did not do better? There are great programmers that came out of the Soviet Union. Remember this. The worse your computers, the better your programmers. And they had, obviously, about the worst computers the world has ever seen. Now, many of these went to Israel. But why is it that we never saw products like SAPs developed there? I mean, SAP was essentially a German firm that built application software on IBM systems. Okay, let's take a look at, you know, some of the economics. A hypothetical firm doing about $2.5 billion in sales may have a total IT budget of roughly 4%, $100 million. That's what it costs day in and day out. Were they to get a bid to outsource, that bid has to come in at least 70 to 80 million. They need at least 20 million saved to get the CFO to act. Okay? Well, that's a $70 million price, but there are some other costs in there if I'm an outsourced vendor. My marketing expense, easily 10%, maybe 15% of cost. I need to make 20 million. So at worst, or at best, that outsourcing firm has a cost structure of one half of its customer. Now, there are some great stories about when this started. I remember a case of Avon. Avon, not a large company, about $2.5 billion, had six data centers. No, that's wrong. They had six divisions. They had 12 data centers because every manager, divisional manager, wanted his own. Didn't want to begin to share. What did Avon do? This was very unique. They called in EDS. Could you give us a proposal? The proposal came in. We can save you 30-40%. And then the internal IT people said, oh, shit. Do we want to work for EDS? Not on your life. Could we propose to do something together? And we can cut our costs 30-40%. Why didn't you guys do this last year? Because EDS didn't show up. But now that they have, we like to protect our jobs. When I look at the cost of software development, hypothetically, a U.S. company will have a 14-cent cost per line of code. An offshore bin, 11 cents, maybe 9. Offshore costs, 5 to 6 cents. So essentially what I'm concluding here is India has a temporary advantage. A temporary advantage. China may also have a temporary advantage, but that temporary may be as long as 10 years. Now, let's look at the world in 2016. This is the same graph again. The powers, China, United States, India, Japan, Germany and the rest of Europe, Africa, relatively unimportant. South America, no. Korea, yes. Korea may be very important. I was over with Nick Negroponte the other day, who is doing one laptop per child. His view is to get a $100 laptop in the hands of the next billion internet users. He's not the only one. AMD has got a 50x15 program that hopes to get 50% of the world's population on the internet by the year 2015. Intel is spending $1 billion to make technology for people in the developing world. Okay, let's look at what criteria might we look at. I picked a few. US, Europe, Japan, China, India. Population, about 300 million here. Europe, slightly more. Japan, not so large, about 130 million. Market size for technology. US and Europe, good. India, maybe third. India has not yet developed that consumer market that drives scale. Infrastructure, India gets a 4. Education, maybe a 4. Cost structure, China will be the number one cost leader. Availability of capital, increasing better. Okay, we started out by saying the world is flat. I suggested that maybe the world is spiky. Not everyone gets to play. Where do new companies come from? Yes, in certain parts of our technology, like communications, China is probably 5 years behind. We see major investments from Motorola and Qualcomm, mainly because of low-cost manufacturing, domestic market, and first-rate talent. What do I see when I see the investments, especially of VCs, in China? Well, they've got 20 years of bad experience. You've got quirky management over there, generally accepted accounting principles that are here are completely different there. The ethics are questionable. Is that a polite way of saying the ethics are questionable? Most of the VCs that I see going into China will get clobbered. They will get robbed blind. They will find their intellectual property seeping out the back door. And when I say this to my friends, they said, yes, we know all that. I said, bend over, grease up? Yeah, we're happy to do that. It's the cost of joining the club. Look at UI versus Cisco. That's a very interesting case. Napoleon said 200 years ago, do not awaken China. But the answer isn't how much GNP goes into R&D. I mean, the U.S., we're about 2.5%. China's goal, 2.5% or 3% by the year 2020. That's not enough just to put the money in. I was reading some of Kevin Maney's stuff the other day about a new box called the 7IP that costs $500 and can drive communications cost in parts of the third world down to 90, cut the cost 99%. When I look at India today, only 3.1% of its 1.1 billion people use the internet. Now, let's go back to talk about capital. The real hero of the venture capital industry is a Bostonian named George Doriot. Doriot started American Research and Development in the late 40s. And he went around to the old money in town and said, you know, we, the old money, have made our money off of slaves, rum, haberdashery, shoes. All those industries have gone south. We have to invest in new things. What does it take to build this? You need about three things. You need first-rate universities and technical schools. You need templates, those that have made it and gotten through the red tape. You need a domestic market. You need sophisticated capital. You need liquidity. Now what? What are the options for India over the next 10 years? Go head-to-head with China in manufacturing? Probably dangerous. Use China to outsource? Also dangerous, but possible. Pick certain areas, go into others, pharma, for example. Maybe pick areas that the Chinese will be viewed as suspect. One of the interesting things about China is they view copying as an art form. You go to France and you say, well, this worked in the United States. But please, monsieur, we are different. I've heard that so often from the French, I can't stand it. The French won't try anything. The Chinese will. The Chinese said, if that works there, let us copy it. If it works, fine. If we can improve it, even better. But we work on an assumption that copying is not a bad thing. Oh, those evil Chinese. Well, I guess we never did anything like that. Au contraire. Francis Cabot Lowell, a Bostonian, 1700s. The United States was seen by Britain as a colony. Mark, if this sounds familiar to you. The United States was seen at the time as a place for raw materials to come from at a low price and a market for finished goods at a high price. If you were a loom designer, you were not allowed to emigrate out of Britain. Every ship was searched for blueprints and destroyed. Lowell, Boston lawyer, he went on factory tours for a year in Britain. He memorized how the looms worked. He came back. He started the entire New England textile industry. Lowell, Massachusetts. He had the Lowell girls who would work very diligently. He was the one that essentially took the United States from an agricultural backwater country into advanced manufacturing. So, what did we do? We stole it. But we stole it fair and square. Oh, really? That's interesting. So we stole. I guess that's the only time. Well, let us not forget the Boxer Rebellion when we were selling in some of the oldest families in Boston opium to the Chinese. I mean, we were in the drug deal business. Yeah, but it's a long time ago. No one remembers. Technology moves in crazy places at crazy speeds. Example, end of the Second World War, the oil companies say, we haven't looked for new oil since the 30s. We've got to supplement what we do from the oil companies, companies like Schlumberger or whatever, with seismologists and geologists. So there was this cute little company in Dallas that did seismic work for the oil companies. Geophysical surveys. And as they started to look for oil in the 1946-47 time frame, they said, you know, our measurements can't really be trusted. Technology has moved ahead. The devices that we are using to even look for oil are obsolete. We better develop our own. So they started a little subsidiary called Texas Instruments. Texas Instruments, you remember, was really the first company to build a computer on the chip. Texas Instruments got so big it was spun off and eventually bought back its parent. A spinoff of TA was Compaq, And you remember Compaq bought digital equipment. Because the needs, the internal market was such, the University of Texas had to build up its electrical engineering department. They had to recruit better faculty, better students. And young Michael Dell walks onto the University of Texas and starts building computers in his dorm room. And that is how technology migrated from New England to Texas, because there was an incipient market. What's China doing? China says two steps. First, we must train teachers. And then when we train teachers, we can train students. We will build 200 new colleges. What will those teachers teach in those colleges? Math and science, and math and science, and math and science. Sometimes to my students at MIT, I said, if there's anybody here that majored in art history, you're at the wrong place. You're going to be very valuable on the cocktail circuit, but there's hard work to do here. So what I see from China is a real 20-year goal: do away with poverty, build consumerism, get scale. Do we have a teacher shortage? Sure we do. Let's recruit from Japan. Let's recruit from Korea. Let's teach them Mandarin. Well, you know the statistics as well as I, the number of engineers that have been built in China. How many does it need? If you look at government in China, it is run by engineers. They go everywhere, business, government, whatever. Literacy in China, 90%. India, maybe 60%. Except in places like Kerala, which is probably 95% literate, only because the communists, God bless them, believed in education. When does the question come up about intellectual property? India, a country of laws, respect for intellectual property. China, an enormous respect for copying. Now, will China respect intellectual property? Possible answers: never. They will do as little as possible, as loudly as possible. We can't control it. It's a local issue. We will tell every computer manufacturer that they must have software on there that comes from the software developer, okay? If you look at the internet in China, where the Chinese government, when it wanted to, could shut that down, then you say, could they solve this problem if they wanted to? They will solve that problem when it suits their purpose. They will solve that problem when they begin to get intellectual capital and property of their own. There were a few people that left a major Chinese communications company and took some intellectual property with them. They have not been seen again. The best people hope for is that they are in jail someplace. Okay, bottom line. We're looking at 2016. We are looking at various forms of attackers. Often the attackers come from below, not above. My view is that India has a bright future, needs a broader base. India has some time, but not a lot of time. The Chinese want all parts of the equation. They want the low cost and the high tech at the same time. They are building the infrastructure, both physical, intellectual, and electronic. Let the games begin. Thank you.
Well, I promised you original insights from Howard, so you got them. I think we'll take two questions, and there's lots of people there, so you can come up to the mics, and so let me start with questions. Any questions? Only two questions, so I want you guys to get the opportunity. Are you coming up, Mintu? Yeah, come up to the mic, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
I just have one question. How do you think China is going to overcome the language barrier?
The question I think you may have heard is, how will China overcome the language barrier? They will require that any engineer be conversant in English, and they're doing that now. Certainly written English, in terms of speaking that problem, it may be 5 or 10 years. It is difficult it is for us to learn Chinese, it is also difficult for them. But they are making that a requirement, and they are pushing that down to 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade, and that will be done. So it will be done in maybe 10 years, and it will be done through education with the next generation.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Second and last question. Thank you.
Well, I have a somewhat, I guess, somewhat lengthy question. It relates to your explanation of the demographics of China and India and education and labor shortages. One of the observations that many people make is that China actually has an aging youth because of the one-child policy, and that the six wallets to one mouth phenomenon is creating a culture of spoiled children that really don't want to work very hard in the next generation. Whereas India, you have 500 million people under the age of 18 that see English and computer literacy as their path to success. Do those dynamics change your outlook?
No, but they certainly reinforce the issue that the socialism of India is a major political force. One of the concomitant benefits, if you want, of a democracy is that people vote. In a country that is not a democracy, what they may do is try and keep a lid on that, and they push the responsibility back on the families. It is the family's responsibility to care for its older members. And that is why a worker in China will send most of his or her paycheck back to their native village. That is something that they are counting on, because they will not embark in major social engineering to bring it up to the standards of the rest of the world. They don't want to bring it up to the standards of the rest of the world. Their advantage is that low cost without the high social cost that goes with it.
Thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you.